Welcome to Dying to Live. I'm Richard Brendan. Those of you who've been listening to this podcast and also radio show on WICR, over the last 17 years, for most of that time, it's been bringing love to life. And I've had some of the top self-help, personal development, spiritual teachers, even recording artists on the radio show, helping you, the listener, learn how to live a more fulfilling, a better life. In February, we launched Dying to Live. Dying to Live was near and dear to my heart. It's conversations on living, loving, and dying, because I realize that the reality of death and the importance of what it means to be alive are actually intimately weaved together by love. You know, when asked, what is the span of a human life, the Buddha is said to have replied, the span of an in-breath and an out-breath. See, the circle of life and death challenges us to face the mystery of it all, as well as practical and profound issues that our society does not address very well. Well, all of that will be the focus on the Dying to Live podcast. But today, I've scheduled guests for future podcasts, but I just wanted to address you, the listener. I don't know who you are. I don't know where you are listening to this. You might be listening on the local radio station here in Indianapolis. You could be listening on iTunes or one of the other avenues we have to go. But something very profound happened to me in 2016. I realized, looking back on a few years prior, that I needed to go through some healing, emotional healing, physical healing. Spent a lot of quality time just being present, being still, backing off from work responsibilities. I think I only spoke twice that year, and it was the best gift I could have given myself. Out of that, which totally surprised me, was a divine download that I got that really changed my life. And that is this, that awareness of death is a secret of life. Now, most of you know I've been also a hospice chaplain all of these years. You know, 5 years one time, 4 years another, but all total about 16 years as a hospice chaplain. And I've had snapshots of that insight, but it was like it dropped from my head into my heart. So as you're sipping a cup of coffee or maybe a glass of wine, if you're listening to this podcast late at night, I want to talk to you personally because I really do care about you. I want to see your light shine. I believe in you, even if I don't even know you. The people that I meet as hospice patients, even facility staff in the various facilities around central Indiana, or when I give keynotes across the country and I meet people for the first time, I love looking into their eyes because the eyes are always the window to the soul. And invariably, all of us have some insecurity we're dealing with, some self-doubts that seem to chain our feet from flying as high and as far as we are called to go. And so what I learned over the years by working with all those brave people facing their mortality is that death actually has a lot to do with how we live fully and how we love well. And it reminds me of a story I read many years ago. I wanted to share it with you right now, but it concerned the Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky. You see, every once in a while, something happens that shakes people out of such a mundane existence and introduces them to the ecstasy that lies waiting with hidden potential to be discovered in everyday life. Well, that was such a something that changed the life of the 19th century Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky. He'd never been an ordinary guy, but it was the experience of a particular moment that gave him the insight that was so much a part of his genius. You see, as a young idealist, Dostoevsky believed that political revolution was the essential route for the life God willed for him. He joined one of the militant socialist movements that seemed to be omnipresent in 19th century Russia. But his efforts to create the kingdom of God by overthrowing the Tsar came to naught, as his mini-revolution failed. And in fact, he was imprisoned by the Tsar, and so he thought, sentenced to death. But he didn't die. You see, those who challenged the Tsar's totalitarian power were sometimes subjected to a cruel psychological trick designed to break their spirits. They were blindfolded and put before a firing squad, and the commands of ready, aim, fire were given, and the sound of shots would ring out, but then nothing. The bullets were blank. The victims had been forced to go through the agony of dying, but then there was not the deliverance that death itself can bring. Well, the painful process was designed to destroy the emotional life of the Tsar's victims, but in the case of Dostoevsky, it ironically provided a whole new way of living it. You see, facing death without dying gave him a new perception of reality and an ability to apprehend life with an appreciative passion. As a moment which he was sure would be his last approached, he found himself living life with a hitherto unknown heightened awareness, and in the face of death, each event that remained in his existence, regardless of how apparently ordinary, took on momentous importance. I mean, think about it. As he ate his last meal, he concentrated on the taste of every bite, savoring every morsel, because he believed this would be the last food he would ever eat. As they marched him into the courtyard where he was to be executed, he took in the sun and breathed the air with an intensive appreciation he had never known before. Because to the condemned Dostoevsky, every sensation was enjoyed with a heightened awareness. Each experience was felt with a powerful sensitivity. He studied the face of each and every soldier charged with the grisly task of shooting him, because these, he was convinced, were the last faces he would ever see. Dostoevsky was living, I mean living, in the face of death. Later, he would confess that he had lived more in what he had been convinced were the last moments of his life than he'd ever lived before. I find that amazing. Each moment and each experience leading up to that mock execution had been seized with a passion, and he had tried to suck out of what remained of life all that is possible it could give. He had learned in the face of death to live out the ancient Latin admonition, carpe diem, seize the day. Which is why one of my favorite movies is Dead Poets Society with Robin Williams, Professor Keating. And if you've seen that movie, it came out decades ago. You remember that scene early in the movie when he takes the class to the trophy case that every high school has. And in the trophy case were trophies, but more importantly, photos of students who have long since died. And Robin Williams, of course, the students were captivated by what he was trying to teach them, and he would have them lean in, would share about that in his own unique way. And he says, and now they're pushing up daisies, but if you listen real closely, you can hear them call. And then he leaned in and he said, carpe, carpe diem, seize the day, boys. I'll never forget that scene. Well, that's what happened to me when on a particular day, didn't know anything significant was going to happen that day, I literally had a divine download that dropped from my head into my heart. And I knew, from knowledge to illumination, that death in its own unique way is truly the secret of life. Now, back to the hospice work I've done. I've been with a number of people who were dying, and I've listened to them express regrets over their nearly completed lives. And I've heard people say, man, I wish I'd spent more time with my children, or my family, or those I love. But you know, I've never heard ever heard a single dying person who said, "I wish I'd spent more time with my business or at the office." You see, being near death offers a person a level of deep sobriety and profound sincerity that most of us do not normally approach. The greatest secrets of almost everyone have to do with not having expressed enough love. And so the message to us, to me, to you, dear friend, is clear. The message is, love is the single most important aspect of life. Now, on this show, I've had plenty of teachers come on and teach us how, through quantum physics and such, we can literally rewire our brains, just like we can rewire a computer program. And what I discovered on that particular day in 2016, that's what happened to me. I discovered that as I gained more awareness, it's always a three-step process: awareness, transformation, mastery. If you want to change your life and live that life truly worth living and not succumb to fear, not succumb to doubt, not succumb to anxiety, like perhaps some of you have, become aware of what you're telling yourself. Because we're constantly speaking to ourselves. So much of what we're saying to ourselves is unconscious, but it's in our thoughts. Thousands and thousands and thousands of thoughts within a 24-hour period. What are those thoughts that you're telling yourself? Is it thoughts of not enough? Is it thoughts of I can't measure up? Or is it thoughts that can lead you a little closer to your destiny, to your purpose in life? What I found is by being around those who were dying, and by focusing on that, which I had a tendency to do, because I found it mysterious and powerful, and I would spend a little bit of time after each death that I attended reflecting on that, I found that the more I did that, the more I was inviting death, I guess you could say, to be my friend. Because I've learned along the way that life and death are part of the same coin. You see, unfortunately, in Western society, we tend to see death as an enemy. In Eastern societies, it's just the opposite. They see it as a friend. In Buddhism, there's a special Buddhist meditation that people go through. And through my Buddhist friends, I learned a little affirmation that to this day I say every morning before I leave the house. And I say, I could die today. And I say it lightheartedly. I don't say it to draw it to myself. But it reminds me that all I have is today. As I'm recording this right now to you, I realize that sitting here in the studio, all I have is this moment, right now, with you. There is no promise about later tonight, certainly no promise about tomorrow. Now, we all say this, but have you ever allowed that truth to drop from your head into your heart, to go from knowledge to illumination? Because, my friend, illumination is what will rock your world, and it will change your life. In the research I've done, I've also come up with some interesting quotes in other stories. I only want to share a few with you today. You know, shortly after the famous psychologist Abraham Maslow suffered a near-fatal heart attack, he wrote this in a letter. Quote, "The confrontation with death and the reprieve from it makes everything look so precious, so sacred, so beautiful, that I feel more strongly than ever the impulse to love it, to embrace it, and to let myself be overwhelmed by it. My river has never looked so beautiful. Death and its ever-present possibility makes love, passionate love, more possible," unquote. That's Abraham Maslow, Hierarchy of Needs. That experience with his heart attack where he thought he was going to die literally changed his life. And we as a civilization benefited from that, given the writings that he had after that. Neil deGrasse Tyson, the astrophysicist, once said, It is the knowledge that I'm going to die that creates the focus that I bring to being alive, the urgency of accomplishment, the need to express love now, not later. I know what he's talking about, because if you know you're going to die, you would have an urgency about you. You would start loving more. You would probably start calling up friends a little bit more frequently. So you would live with no regrets, because you realize, you know, somehow unconsciously we tend to think we're going to live forever. I know if I were to ask you that, you'd say, oh, no, I know I'm going to die at some point. But unconsciously we do, and we fritter our life away every day. The great Michael A. Singer, in his New York Times best-selling book, The Untethered Soul, wrote this: "It is truly a great cosmic paradox that one of the best teachers in all life turns out to be death. No person or situation could ever teach you as much as death has to teach you. Learn to live as though you were facing death at all times, and you'll become bolder and more open. If you live life fully, you won't have any last wishes." Again, that's from the book, The Untethered Soul. And so what he's reminding you and reminding me is that if we're looking for better life, if we're looking to fully actualize our talents and our powers to create the life of our dreams, perhaps the tool we need to be using is embracing our own death. I know that sounds kind of odd. And for some of you, this might be the last thing you want to hear. You're looking for the next best-selling book. You probably go to the spirituality personal development section at the libraries or Borders bookstore or Amazon constantly. I was addicted to that stuff for years. And then I realized it's not about personal or spiritual development. It's really about remembrance. Remembering who you already are, that you're already great, that you're already beautiful, that you're already talented, that you already have within you all the love you will ever, ever need. And yet we can get addicted to looking and seeking outside of ourselves. Death has a way of stopping us in our tracks. I've shared on this podcast before, all the great non-duality teachers like Eckhart Tolle or Jeff Foster or Miranda McPherson, one of the commonalities they've all had is they all suffered with severe depression. They had to have a moment in their life when they hit rock bottom. For Eckhart, it was hitting rock bottom and waking up on a park bench. And he came out of that pretty much enlightened and just started going from house to house, teaching through question and answer what he experienced. Mark Allen with New World Library was smart enough. He heard about him, tracked him down, and they created a book that became an international bestseller called The Power of Now. That's what I'm talking about. His brain was rewired. And what I'm telling you, dear friend, is you can choose to rewire your brain right now, today. You don't need a near-death experience. You don't need to be pronounced terminal by a doc. By a choice. By being aware of the choices you're making. By being aware of the thoughts you're telling yourself. By being aware and then making a shift, a transformation, if you will. That's how we change habits. In about 3 weeks' time, you will have mastery and a new life. So, since that experience I had in 2016, every time I give a talk on the art of living and dying, wherever it is in the country, even here in Indianapolis, I always, almost always, open up with this, and I say this: love calls you to make death your constant companion, because the awareness of death helps you heal old wounds, it refines your purpose, and you lead a fearless an authentic life. Because I'm telling you, if you knew you're going to die, that's what happens. Automatically, your brain is rewired. You will all of a sudden start realizing, what is it I really want to do? Because I don't know if I have forever. And you won't need to process and read, constantly read and constantly go to workshops trying to figure this out. It will just happen. And what I have found in working with those who are dying over a 16-year period is something else miraculously takes place also, and that is it almost gives you permission to finally be the kind of person you've wanted to be, to do the kind of things you've wanted to do or to say the things you've always wanted to say. That's what I've learned in my years of working with the dying. I've learned a few other things, too, and I just want to share a few with you in the time that we have. I came across, as I'm putting together a book that I'm working on, I came across a post that I made on Facebook, and I just want to read this post to you. This was in November 2016, and I wrote this. Earlier today, I had the honor of officiating the funeral of an 89-year-old woman who made her transition on October 27th. For almost a year, I would visit with her, often holding her hand and reading poetry to her. And when I would sing to her, she would laugh. I'd try to sing along with me. I still remember that. My attempt at the Sinatra song, Fly Me to the Moon, because I knew that was her favorite song, so instead of just playing it, you know, Richard decided to sing it to her, and I memorized the words. Well, she was unable to speak the words, but her smile in her eyes said everything. And then I wrote, she's flying now, and perhaps she's even dancing with Sinatra. The following words from John O'Donohue really touched my heart. And here's the quote I shared on that post from John O'Donohue. We should not allow ourselves to settle for being awkward and unsure about a deathbed. There's a vital and beautiful work to be done there. When you realize that the dying person needs and depends on your words and presence, it takes the focus off your limitation and frees you to become a creative companion on that new journey. One of the most beautiful gifts you could ever give is the gift of helping someone to die with dignity, graciousness, and serenity. That lady taught me by me trying to serve her, by bringing joy into what day she had left. It taught me to get out of my comfort zone, man. See, I love to sing. Am I a great singer? Oh, God, no. But I love to sing. And she basically, without even uttering a word, gave me permission to sing to her. And that smile that she had, and a little bit of giddiness it gave her, it did more for me than probably her. So I learned to start saying or singing more than what I used to, because I don't know how long I have. I've learned also in working with the dying, in companioning with them, and even their family members sometimes, that I've learned the ultimate expression of love is actually to take someone deeply into your heart and to offer the precious gift of being heard and seen without being judged. Because after all, only love is safe enough to come out to. And so I'm not perfect at it, but my work in death and dying taught me to try to do that with the people that I meet. Even facility staff is when they have something to say to me, to don't look at my watch, don't look at my phone, turn it off if I can, if I know it's going to be a longer conversation, and truly be present with them because I don't know when I'm going to see them again. And I want to make sure in that moment they feel seen and they feel deeply heard. And so I've learned that that is one of the greatest gifts. It's nothing to buy. It's being present with the precious people in your life. I learned from Anita Morjani when she crossed over and came back and wrote that best-selling book, I'm Dying to Be Me. Anita Morjani was diagnosed with terminal cancer and was just hours away from death when she crossed over and had a choice to come back or not. And she returned with a clear understanding of her life purpose and shared the biggest reason she learned from her near-death experience. And that biggest lesson she learned, having died and came back, was this. That is to love yourself first, above all other things. Now, someone's listening to me right now who needs to hear that message. You could tune everything else out I said. But you need to hear this, because you're not loving yourself. You're beating yourself up. You know you are. And you could be a great caregiver, giving love to everyone else but yourself. But it took Anita to die on an operating table in Hong Kong and then come back for her to learn that the most important lesson of all is to love yourself first above all other things. She still believes that self-love feeds all of other energy we put into this life. And so, I wanted to give you one or two assignments. And if you just listen closely, you don't have to write these down, but if you go to iTunes, and if you're listening to iTunes right now in this podcast, you can listen to it again and write it down. But these are exploring life-affirming death awareness exercises that will eventually go into this book one day that I hope to publish. Here's the first exercise. Focus on what unites us. Pick a time period, a few hours a day, longer, in which you focus on what you have in common with each person you see or interact with, whether you know them or not. They, like you, are going to one day die. They, like you, are confused and frightened by this knowledge and tend to think or feel about it as little possible. And they, like you, may have a dull look in their eyes or rigid expression on their face, partly because they're using up precious psychic energy to repress their death anxiety. Note what you are feeling as you engage in this exercise, particularly any feelings of compassion or empathy for yourself or others. How does this exercise make you feel? Does this exercise in any way change how you feel towards others? Perhaps extend this exercise by meeting with people you normally dislike or disagree with and note whether any change in your normal feelings arise as a result. So once again, the exercise is pick a time period, a few hours a day, in which you focus on what you have in common with each person you see or interact with, whether you know them or not. Second exercise, and be the last one for today. Appreciate a last meal or a walk. Now I'm thinking of the Dostoevsky story. Here's the exercise. Set aside a time when you can eat a meal alone in a quiet place and imagine it's the last meal you will ever eat. Eat slowly, noting each smell, how each component of the meal tastes, everything it took for this meal to reach you, from the life of the animal or plant involved, to the apparatus, to the farmer, transport, supermarket, required to get this food to you. Note your feelings at the prospect that this will be the last meal you will ever eat in this lifetime. Or set a time to take a walk, imagining it's the last walk you will ever take on this earth. Walk extremely slowly, taking the time to smell, hear every sound, see every sight. Note the feelings that arise, whether sadness that you will never have this experience again, or gratitude that you've been able to have this experience of life. And as you return to daily life, reflect on whether these experiences change how you might want to eat or take walks from here on out. And so, I opened up with a story about Dostoevsky. It's one of my favorite stories because I can't imagine going through what he went through, and then in fact how it did rewire his brain to change his life. But now I want to talk just briefly about Cyrus McCormick. And most of you are saying, who? Well, Cyrus McCormick, who invented the Reaper and founded the company that became International Harvester, by the way, the company my father worked for 28 years, that's why I knew who Cyrus was. Cyrus McCormick, who invented the Reaper and founded the company that became International Harvester, was a generous contributor to Chicago's Presbyterian Theological School. And because of that fact, the school later changed its name to McCormick Theological Seminary. And faculty and students have quipped that death is never referred to as the green Grim Reaper at McCormick, but always as the International Harvester. Ha ha ha. Grim is not a word which describes the experience of many people who find themselves nearing life's end. Like Dr. Abraham Maslow commented, as I shared with you earlier, after a heart attack, which made him realize that his own death was not far away. Likewise, psychiatrist Irvin Yalom, who worked with terminally ill cancer patients, reported that grimness was far from their attitudes about passing on. You see, according to Dr. Chris Thurman in his book, The Truths We Must Believe, Yalom tells us that once his patients accepted the fact that their lives were rapidly drawing to an end, in other words, they befriended their death, they invited death to join them in life. Once they did that, positive and exciting changes occurred. Now, these are terminally ill cancer patients. Here's what he found in his research. They felt a sense of freedom to do what they wanted to do. They began to live in and enjoy the present, unlike ever before. They learned to vividly appreciate the world around them. They joyously anticipated holidays. They communicated deeper with loved ones. And they feared less. And they even risked more. Because these people knew they were dying, they figured out how to live. Huh. How about that? They came alive in ways they never dreamed possible. Now, maybe you don't want to volunteer to leave this life today, but we'll each set off on that journey soon enough. And it promises to be an exciting adventure. But in the meantime, what if you set out to live every moment as if your short days here were truly numbered? I believe when the International Harvester someday reaps your life, it will have been joyful, fearless, and well-lived. I wish you well on your journey, and whoever you are, wherever you are, I'm sending you lots of love, and thank you for listening. This has been Dying to Live, and I'm Richard Brendan.